Hi, I'm Kristen Bell. And if you know my husband, Dax, then you also know he loves shopping for a car. Selling a car? Not so much.
We're really doing this, huh?
Thankfully, Carvana makes it easy. Answer a few questions, put in your VIN or license, and done. We sold ours in minutes this morning, and they'll come pick it up and pay us this afternoon.
Bye-bye, Truckee.
Of course, we kept the favorite.
Hello, other Truckee.
Sell your car with Carvana today. Terms and conditions apply.
Expecting heavy downpours all day today.
You're a builder. You build. It's literally in your job title.
Woo! Let's hit it.
A little rain isn't stopping you. Not today, not any day. Shouldn't your flashing tape be working through it all too? Only Frog Tape Pro Grade Flashing Tape's high-performance acrylic adhesive sticks, re-sticks, and stays stuck, even on the roughest surfaces in rain, snow, heat, and more. So you stay in control when it matters most. Show weather who's boss with Frog Tape Pro Grade Flashing Tape.
Some crimes are so heartbreaking or shocking that they change laws, change society, or even earn the label crime of the century. But the stories that made headlines in decades past aren't necessarily remembered today. I'm Amber Hunt, a journalist and author, and in each episode of this show, I'll examine a case that's maybe lesser known today, but was huge when it happened. This is Crimes of the Centuries. Nine days after the disaster, Queen Elizabeth II went to the small village in South Wales to see for herself what nature and negligence had done. She went, of course, to comfort the living, to assure them that the nation grieved with them. She wanted them to know she shared in the loss and heard their building frustration. She also must have unconsciously shown them that she could fix none of what had happened here. What had happened here in Aberfan, Wales, was a veritable avalanche of something like 2.1 million cubic meters of coal slag, or about 360,000 tons of it, stored rather precariously on a wet hillside below the Merthyr Vale Colliery. The pile of detritus had lost its footing as recent heavy rains had undermined whatever hold it had on the hillside. The refuse pile was officially called a tip, which is just waste material left over after coal extraction. It consists of rocks, dirt, hazardous chemicals, limestone, sandstone, siltstone, and shale rocks, all manner of which are found within the earth next to coal, a carbonized fossil fuel made from plant material subjected to heat and pressure over millions of years. The failure of the tip was a long time brewing, but it began to show itself to the miners around 7:30 on the excessively foggy morning of October 21, 1966. That's when the contents of the tip were found to have sunk 10 feet overnight. No one seemed to be in an urgent state to alert authorities to the event. Reports differ on whether mining stopped while the tip was inspected further or if it continued on above it, adding more overage for another 90 minutes. What is known is that there were no phone lines on the mountain and thus no phone to call below to ask for advice or give someone some kind of warning, if anyone would have thought that was necessary. Still, around 9 that morning, a coal worker began to walk down the hillside to explain the somewhat worrying situation to his bosses. By now, according to the Yorkshire Post, which created a timeline of the tragedy, the slurry pond had sunk another 10 feet. The guy sent to alert his superiors did not arrive in time to tell anybody. At 9:15, the tip gave way. The black mass that had been lodged 500 feet above the village below did not flow down like a slow freight train easing itself down the mountain. It came more like a glistening, two-story-high mudslide at about 80 miles per hour, complete with a deafening roar that drowned out anyone who might have yelled out a warning to those below. Below was the town of Aberfan, which 5,000 residents called home. But directly below, in harm's way, was the junior school where kids had just sat down at their desks, eagerly preparing for the end of term, which would cut that Friday short. The kids had only been in their classrooms and in their seats since 9 a.m. when the school day began.
The enormous refuse tip from Abavan's coal mine lost its footing on the steep slopes above the village, and a black avalanche slid onto the houses and the school below.
One of the surviving teachers at the school remembers seeing the light flicker and sway, then saw something out the window, something emerging from the mist. Something like a black boulder racing toward the back of the red brick schoolhouse where 260 students were delighting in Library Day. Afterward, the school had simply crumpled onto itself. The slurry would have stopped moving, but the water from the broken main had started feeding it so that it began to move again. Hetty Williams, a 21-year-old teacher at the time, revisited the scene years later.
This was where my classroom was. On the anniversary, I come back to the school because that's where my memories are. And I can still see the children in their classes and things. There's a tree over there that's twisted, and I've taken a fancy to the tree. So I like to go there and put my flowers under that tree and can feel my children around me. And you can think back to the days when it was a lovely place.
But back to the moments after the disaster. Children who were not killed in the initial crush were then threatened with drowning in the torrent of water and muck. Before the massive sludge hit the Pant Glass Junior School and part of the county secondary school, it had already taken out a farmhouse and cottages in its way, killing everyone inside. It then severed a water main and easily overran the railroad tracks and the embankment that held them. More than 18 more houses were also destroyed when the mass reached the bottom of the hill. Even more were severely damaged. And many coal miners who worked the night shift were trying to get to sleep. In the blink of an eye, a seeming freight train hit the school and the village, and nothing would ever be the same again. How could it? An entire generation of children had been slaughtered. Everyone in town had some stake in that school and in that mine, and the company that employed them. Even to this day, Abervon is remembered for its incalculable loss and for what came after. But it is also remembered for something that Queen Elizabeth did on the day she toured the ruins and witnessed the anguish and saw the rows of freshly dug graves for the children who had been suffocated to death under tons of coal refuse. Biographers insist it is the first time that the nation, indeed the world, ever saw her cry.
When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper. Distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard-of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at Remarkable.com today.
Abervon started as small a community as you can imagine. In its beginning, there were just two cottages and an inn that drew local farmers as overnight guests, plus an occasional bargeman or two. It was tiny enough that its establishment date is linked only to the founding of the Merthyr Vale Colliery in 1869. That's when it became something of a town, though even by 1966, it wasn't much of one. When news began to spread that a disaster had struck it, most folks in Britain couldn't have pointed to Abervon on a map. That changed with the disaster, which prompted journalists to arrive en masse to report on scenes of absolute horror.
A generation perished in Abavan. In a few minutes, nearly 200 children, happy because they would begin a holiday that afternoon, were engulfed. And for them, there was no holiday, no half term. It was to be their final term.
In the immediate aftermath of the disaster, anyone left in the village tried to dig out the few children they could hear struggling and screaming in the mire. The coal miners and the professional miner rescue teams rushed to the scene. Len Haggett, one of the first responders.
And if you ever asked, what resources would you want at an incident of that nature? We had the best in the world. We had the miners. They were the boys who could shift the slurry. And they worked a very good system. They would be working, and suddenly you'd hear a whistle blow, and they'd say silence. And how you could obtain silence in those circumstances with that number of people who were present is difficult to imagine, and yet it was. You got absolute silence, hoping that you would hear a voice or a call so you could rescue them.
It was even more horrifying than it sounds. As policewoman Yvonne Price remembers.
When we were passing the dead children through, one man just looked down and just turned and looked at me and he said, "That was my child." Oh. That was one of the worst things. And he just carried on working.
The children, laid out on the pews in the local Bethania Chapel, had to be identified, a task made more difficult because they had all been in uniform and there was little option but to wipe the filth from their faces to find if this dead child was yours. Much of the rescue work had been without success. After 11 that morning, despite round-the-clock efforts, no one else was found alive. One boy pulled from the debris had been pinned for 90 minutes with a dead girl's head lying against his left shoulder the entire time. Of the 34 students in his class, he was only one of four to survive. Soon enough, neighbors came from miles around to bucket brigade the waste removal and to relieve the mothers who had been digging with their bare hands. The final count of the dead was 144, 116 of them children between the ages of 7 and 10. Five of those found buried in the muck were their teachers. 28 other children were injured, many quite seriously. Survivor Phil Thomas.
I woke, pitch black, bedded, couldn't see a thing. Started crying, shouting for me mum.
It was, and still is, the worst mining disaster in British history. Lord Snowden, Princess Margaret's husband, was of Welsh heritage and immediately packed a shovel and arrived at the site at 2 a.m. He spent his time visiting the injured and comforting the bereaved. After waiting more than a day to arrive, Lord Alfred Robins, chair of the National Coal Board, finally arrived on scene. The BBC took note of his delayed arrival.
The NCB's boss, Lord Robins, was due to be installed as Chancellor of the University of Surrey on the day of the disaster. And he would not be diverted from travelling to Guildford to perform his duties in cap and gown.
Robins explained,
"I am not an engineer. I am not a person who could take charge of rescue operations. So I dispatched the best man in my industry, that is the chief mining engineer, to ensure that everything possible is done in a physical way to rescue people."
Robins straight away told reporters and onlookers that there was an underground spring under tip number 7. That small comment was seen as an admission of responsibility for the accident on the part of the NCB. He would later disavow this, saying that he had only tried to remove the blame from the coal tip crew. The Queen sent her husband to the village that day as well, while bodies were still being found and separated from the heap. According to the BBC, journalists who had arrived later reported that Prince Philip was visibly shaken by the tragedy and insisted a total lack of protocol as he spoke to survivors and parents of the dead. Nearly a week passed before the final body was recovered, interrupted by plans for burying the children together as a memorial to the tragedy. The finger-pointing about blame began, of course, from the first day, with serious questions being aired at a high-level government tribunal of inquiry, which would determine who was actually at fault and why no one had stopped what looked like an inevitable calamity. In January 1967, a disaster appeal fund was established that would eventually raise £1.75 million. Doing some complicated math, that's about $52 million in today's American dollars. It was an amount unprecedented for the time, and a true indication of how the British nation took the town under its wing to try to ease their pain in any way possible. The question before us is who, not what, killed 144 people that day? Because this was not a so-called act of God or a natural disaster. Men mined that coal on that hill and put that tip where it put people in peril. And others had tried to warn them that disaster was possible. In 1944, and again in early 1963, two separate tips above Aberfan also caromed down the hill and hit the village, but without calamity. The 1963 incident was followed by a waterworks engineer identified as D.C.W. Jones, writing a letter to a T. Ritchie, District Public Works Superintendent, voicing his concern that the tip was a danger to, very specifically, Pantglass Junior School in Aberfan. Per the Yorkshire Post, his letter read, quote, "The slurry is so fluid and the gradient so steep that it could not possibly stay in position in the wintertime or during periods of heavy rain," end quote. Jones followed that up with a letter to the National Coal Board. It read, quote, "You are no doubt well aware that the tips at Merthyr Vale Tower above the Pantglass area, and if they were to move, a very serious position would accrue," end quote. In 1964, local councilwoman Gwyneth Williams also wrote a letter saying the coal waste, quote, "could threaten the whole school," end quote. In January 1965, two mothers of children who attended the school approached the school's headmistress, Ann Jennings, with a petition signed by dozens of parents that outlined serious local concern over tip number 7, especially after rains. Jennings took the petition to the local council to no avail. She was among those killed when the slurry slammed into the school. The scenes that played out on October 21, 1966, remain lodged firmly in the minds of those children, now adults, who survived the crush of sodden earth. I share these not to belabor the point, but to convey just how devastating this disaster was and continues to be half a century later. Jeff Edwards, just 8 years old and the last child taken out alive, told the BBC in 2021 that he had to grow up quickly in that moment, hearing the screams for help that, too soon, died away while he waited to be buried alive. He had done that with a little girl dead and lying against him, her face turned up to him as the two remained in place for 2 hours while he prayed to be found. He said,
"The most distressing thing was this girl's head on my shoulder and the inability really to get away from that. And subsequently, you know, I used to have terrible nightmares for many, many years after, having sight of that girl in my memory all the time. It was so upsetting. And I still have those nightmares on occasions. I still suffer from deep bouts of depression."
Gaynor Madgwick was also 8. She remembered that children were literally frozen in their seats by the sludge. She had seen the oncoming mass and had gotten up to run. The force of the muck colliding with the school had catapulted her to the very back of the classroom, where she remained for a bit, silent and in shock. Then she saw a child's arm sticking through a crack in the wall. She repeatedly pinched the hand, begging it to move, even holding on to it. as if, you know, she needed the reassurance that holding hands can give. Later, when she found out that her brother had died in the crash, she told the BBC that, quote, "I always hold on to the hope that with me holding on to that child's hand, it could have been my brother's. I hold on to that," she said. "It gives me comfort," end quote. Some of the eventual 2,500 rescue workers that day reported finding children still sitting at their desks, entombed by the muck. Some remembered the bleeding, flesh-torn fingers of mothers who were frantically digging out the earth with their bare hands before even the miners got there to help with proper tools. And many in Britain at the time can still remember the words of the BBC's Cliff Mitchell-Moore reporting from the scene. In tears, he said, quote, "Never in my life have I seen anything like this. I hope I shall never see anything like it again. For years, of course, the miners have been used to disaster. Today, for the first time in history, the roll call was called in the streets. It was the miners' children," end quote. 3 days later, a coroner's inquest began to determine the cause of death. In a public reading of the coroner's report, the cause of death for most of the victims had been suffocation and massive crush injuries, specifically to the skull. The Merthyr Express reported, quote, "As one name was read out and the cause of death given as asphyxia and multiple injuries, the father of the child said, 'No, sir, buried alive by the National Coal Board.'" One of the only two women among the 60 people at the inquest at Sion Primitive English Methodist Chapel at Aberfan shouted through her tears, "They have murdered our children." Then a number of people called out and got to their feet. The coroner tried to restore order and said, "I know your grief is such that you may not be realizing what you are saying." The father repeated, "I want it recorded. Buried alive by the National Coal Board. This is what I want to see on the record. That is the feeling of those present. Those are the words we want to go on the certificate," end quote. The coroner issued the death certificates without that designation. The first burials came a little after that report, but a mass funeral for the 81 children was held October 27, 1966. The children were placed together in two separate trenches, each 80 feet long. The tribunal, a more formal venue, was impaneled. Put in charge was Lord Justice Edmund Davies, a native of a mining community like Aberfan, also located in South Wales. In an unusual move, lawyers were provided and legal costs paid so that Aberfan's parents and residents could be represented at the tribunal. Everyone knew this would be a painful and difficult fact-finding mission, flush with raw emotion and bitter anger from people who had had no time to heal, if they ever could. It was also complicated by bureaucracy and ass covering, and the truth about life in a coal mining town in 1966. That truth? Merthyr Vale was a large mine, one of hundreds in Wales. The industry itself was in a bit of a decline by 1966, having served its country very well during the Industrial Revolution and the last Great World War. Control of mining throughout Great Britain was nationalized in 1947, which is only important to know because, as the BBC explained in a special report on the accident's 50th anniversary, quote, "In the post-war corporatist climate of the 1960s, the National Coal Board was held in what now seemed uncomfortable reverence. The working man knew his place, authority knew best," end quote. And the National Coal Board had been just fine with what Merthyr Vale had been doing up there above Aberfan. They were most certainly okay with the geological circumstance of tip number 7 when it was started in 1958 on highly porous sandstone that was sitting on overground as well as underground streams. When it had slipped a bit in 1963, complaints did not cause concern for or summon reaction from the National Coal Board. Many would later say that the NCB had held an almost invisible sword above the heads of the miners in Aberfan. "Complain and we'll close the mine. You like eating, don't you? And so, miners did not insist, or couldn't. Coal kept Abervon, its schools, churches, bakeries, auto shops, doctors, dentists, and milkmen, afloat. The tribunal into the tragedy was characterized by the NCB's sullen attitude and excuse-making. The board had its story, and it was sticking to it. After all, Lord Robin's position was made clear before he even spoke to the tribunal. The NCB was not at fault here, specifically because, he maintained, it was impossible to have known that there was a spring in the heart of the tip. This despite his words spoken on the streets of Abervon less than 2 days after the atrocity. Yet the whole of the NCB, its engineers, managers, and inspectors, kept to the party line, even though the underground springs that undermine the tip appeared on ordnance survey maps in 1919 and on geological survey maps made in 1959. The miners, suddenly uncowed by the NCB's power, would not hesitate to tell what they had seen with their own eyes that day. The BBC's Thomas Morgan explained,
"A tribunal was set up to inquire why and how this disaster had happened. Lasting 76 days, it was the longest of its kind at the time, with over 100 people interviewed and 300 exhibits examined."
In front of the tribunal, a tipping gang worker remembered how the slide began. He spoke of how the whole mass of sludge had sunk almost 20 feet into the ground. Quote, "It was starting to come back up. It started to rise slowly at first, sir. I thought I was seeing things. Then it rose up pretty fast, sir, at a tremendous speed." End quote. Then it looked like a wave. Then all of it came shooting out. Think of it like a volcanic eruption, but wetter and faster. Other miners told of knowing that the underground spring was there and had always been there. They explained that they had played up there as children. On February 26, 1967, the Sunday Times of London wrote, quote, "On most of the 48 days of the Abervon inquiry so far, the coal board has been under attack. The board's main case for its defense will be that the disastrous slide of a waste tip, which buried alive 144 people, was unforeseeable because its root case was a coincidence of geological factors, each of which were not exceptional. No surface observation, the board will claim, could have detected the particular danger." End quote. So violent was the slide that they insisted it could not have been anticipated. Some refused to recognize that the tip had failed before in 1963. Just didn't happen, they said, despite irrefutable evidence to the contrary. More importantly, they gave no reason for the fact that, in the 4 years prior to the fatal 1966 avalanche, no inspector from Her Majesty's Inspectorate of Mines and Quarries, which had a divisional office in nearby Cardiff, had visited the Merthyr Vale Colliery Tip Complex. When the senior inspector who had been with the inspectorate for decades was asked about the 1944 slide, he said he hadn't heard of it until 1966. Only one witness owned up to any part of the catastrophe, a mechanical engineer named Vivian Thomas, who represented the lowest tier of responsibility in the coal board echelon, told the tribunal, "I had no instructions at all about the tips, but I am responsible. It's no good shirking it. I was responsible for the tip." His statement barely made a ripple. It was all so much bureaucratic double talk. That is, until a teacher at the nearby senior school, which had also been struck, testified that seconds after the wall of fury hit the buildings,
"Everything was so quiet. And as if nature had realized that a tremendous mistake had been made, and nature was speechless."
In the final days of the tribunal, though, sworn under oath to tell the truth, Lord Robins was forced to admit that, quote, "the unforeseeability argument was untenable," end quote. Thus, in August 1967, The tribunal reported that, quote, blame for the disaster rests upon the National Coal Board. The legal liability of the National Coal Board to pay compensation is uncontested, end quote. As Ian McLean and Martin Jones wrote in Abervan, Government and Disaster, their seminal work dissecting the aftermath of the tragedy, quote, these dry conclusions belie the passion of the preceding text. The tribunal was appalled by the behavior of the National Coal Board and some of its employees, both before and after the disaster. It rejected accusations of callous indifference on the part of the NCB, but instead concluded, there are no villains in this harrowing story. But the Abervan disaster is a terrifying tale of bungling ineptitude by many men charged with tasks for which they were totally unfitted, or failure to heed clear warnings and of total lack of direction from above, end quote. The report then actually named the nine men it was referring to. The distinguished BBC commentator Vincent Kane noted in Gaynor Madgwick's memoir that the nine were scapegoats because everyone knew how blame could be shared. Quote, they knew, they all knew, the council, the Abervan community, anybody who read the Merthyr Express, the head schoolmistress, the colliery employees who worked on top of the tip and who were still tipping until the tip started to go, and all the managers and engineers who were eventually pilloried by the tribunal. They all knew that there was a question mark over the safety of tip number 7, but they preferred to look the other way, end quote. Because no one wanted coal to die, not the unions, not the coal board, not the Conservative Party, not the Labour Party. So nobody spoke up. The irony of this is beyond sad. When the number 7 tip was finally shut down, mining didn't stop at Merthyr Vale. In fact, it outlasted the National Coal Board and did not close shop until 1989, 23 years after the blackness enveloped all those children, freezing them in place in mud that felt like cement. But, you might ask, did the named nine have to answer for their neglect? After all, it was a crime committed against a whole town. It was time someone paid, wasn't it? I won't try to understand the ins and outs of British law or governmental authority. Let's just say that there was a call for Lord Roban's resignation, which he offered, but was not accepted and, oddly enough, not even supported by the citizens of Abervan. The parliamentary debate after the tribunal report landed brought up the rather itchy question of how the NCB should be held accountable, if not by criminal indictment, because children had been killed. Yeah, well, it was in the late 19th century when the United States Supreme Court, affirming a position taken by the California courts, set forth the precedent that corporations were persons. Well, actually, they decided that corporations had the same legal rights and responsibilities as enjoyed by a natural person, which has come in mighty handy if you're a corporation or one of its directors. Admittedly, a completely capitalistic concept, the whole thing seems to break down when it comes to criminal culpability. The list of corporations that have gotten away with murder includes, but is most certainly not limited to, the Triangle Shirtwaist Company, Dow Chemical, ExxonMobil, All American Tobacco Companies, Union Carbide, Monsanto, Nestle, Pacific Gas and Electric, almost every pharmaceutical company known to man, and I'm tired now. In every case where the corporation was charged with murder or manslaughter, only a few made it to court. In the case of Union Carbide and its culpability for what happened in Bhopal, India in early December of 1984, the Indian government wished to hold individual corporation bigwigs responsible at trial. The U.S. government would not extradite them. Still, somewhere deep down, I think we all believe that rights come with responsibilities, as does the burden of personal behavior. Exempting corporations from criminal liability, as suggested by a June 2020 story in The Hill, quote, creates a two-tier system of legal personhood, one where, perversely, we individuals are on the bottom tier, end quote. And yes, I know I'm talking about America here. A similar evolution happened across the pond. It was in the late 19th century that corporations in Britain were declared separate legal persons. Later, in 1926, a judge decided that a corporation couldn't be indicted for offenses against a person. I'm not sure how a corporation can be given the rights of a person yet not face the same repercussions of criminal acts that a person would face, but what do I know? I just have a heart and common sense. So on August 4th, 1967, it was announced that there would be no charges against individuals for what happened in Aberfan. The nine men named in the tribunal report would walk away scot-free, the BBC reported.
They weren't disciplined, they weren't demoted, and they certainly weren't sacked.
A week later, the Parents and Residents Association of Aberfan publicly announced they were unanimously against prosecuting any coal board officials implicated in the disaster. They explained that no such prosecution will be brought by them or on their behalf. The group said its members fully accepted the findings of the tribunal, but added, quote, "There is no question of their pursuing any vendetta or seeking retribution from those who have been found to be blameworthy," end quote. I'm going to have to tell you straight out that I would not have then, nor would I now, ever be so forgiving a human being. If I had seen what those parents saw that day, mercy or rationality would not be on the menu. So let's just say I'm baffled here, plain and simple. What were those parents thinking, absolving people who were so clearly in the wrong? There is little in the literature or in the extant documents that explains it. Maybe they were tired. Maybe they knew that retribution changes nothing, and there's no such thing as closure. Or maybe they just didn't know yet that the compensation they were due for loss and personal injury from the NCB would be disputed for 30 more years. A few days after the tribunal ruled, the death certificates for those killed that day were corrected. The cause of death was determined to be accidental. In any case, no one was charged with any crime. No one even lost their job. That includes Lord Robins. The residents' and parents' grief, of course, was never over, and neither was the pain. In no small measure because who would get the money and in what amount and when were in constant flux. The Charity Relief Fund had no real trustee early on, and distribution of the desperately needed cash was complicated by the introduction of the National Union of Miners, the local area council, Welsh politicians, and the recently formed and ostensibly well-meaning Management Committee of the Disaster Fund. In 1968, S.O. Davies, the Member of Parliament from Aberfan, resigned as part of that latter committee because he was a principled man who simply could not abide a decision the government made regarding the fund. That is, the British government withdrew £150,000 out of the total to remove the tip that had annihilated half the children in town and was still situated up there gathering refuse on a daily basis. Really, the symbol of all their pain standing on high above them, like some vengeful god about to send down more muck and destruction every time it rained? I remain astonished at the deliberate cruelty we inflict upon each other. Anyway, the residents of Aberfan were told over and over that the tip was safe. Of course, they'd been told that before October 21st, 1966. To add insult to injury, the government even went so far as to ask local taxpayers in Wales to pay for that tip's removal before they decided the money would come from that rich font of donated cash given to those who had been harmed the most by the tsunami of coal refuse spewed from that quote-unquote safe tip. But that wasn't the only issue to be reckoned with. There were the usual problems that arise when money is to be apportioned, with people sending in receipts to pay for paper cups and sandwich bags used while rescuers rescued. Then there was the logistical matter of how to get real money into the hands of those who needed it. Eventually, the NCB parted with a total of £160,000 to assuage their guilt. That was shared, with a payout of about £500 for each fatality, with cash given out as well as to those whose property had been damaged or decimated. A small, little evil aside, the NCB first offered only £50 per dead kid. I could gag. It was also inhumane and slow, from a documentary by Fascinating Horror.
A government organization responsible for regulating charities prevented the fund from paying out in many cases. Payments were forbidden where children were traumatized but not physically injured by the disaster.
The donated money in the relief fund had specifically been designated, quote, for the relief of all persons who had suffered as a result of the said disaster and thereby in need, end quote. That was a tad vague, though everyone agreed that it was appropriate for the fund to pay for the memorial to those who died that day. Various amounts to be paid each family who had lost someone were highly debated, eventually landing on $5,000 per, figuring that would cover a whole host of issues should they arise. Then this happened.
And the Charity Commission also insisted that the Disaster Relief Fund ascertain that parents had been close to their deceased children before making any payments.
As in, the commission wanted proof that parents who had lost children were suffering mentally from the loss. What the hell? I'm glad to report that cooler minds prevailed and that little caveat was removed from the decision, and everybody who lost a child got $5,000 each for their pain. However, many in authority worried that the residents of Abervon would not know how to properly use that much money. If that weren't demeaning enough, the parents of those whose children had been in the school that day and had not died were not to be similarly compensated. And this is stupid. I understand it's hard to put a dollar amount on this stuff, but somewhere there has to be a consideration that there will be a lot more to deal with. How much will it cost to find and treat the lingering trauma of the event itself and all the days that followed it? How can you fix a town full of the bereaved? How can you pay forward for the anticipated post-traumatic stress? How do you help a community recover from something everyone experienced and in which everyone lost? According to authors McLean and Jones, quote, the depth of the trauma that the disaster had inflicted quickly became apparent. In the first few weeks after the disaster, a psychiatrist noted, disorders of sleep, changes of mood, anxiety symptoms, changes in behavior, phobic reactions, physical or psychosomatic symptoms, end quote. And this wasn't just the children. In fact, the symptomology in adults was judged to be significantly more severe than found in the children. Jeff Edwards, the last child to be rescued.
Most of my friends perished in that disaster. So my childhood ended on that day, really. And I had to become a different person after. And you definitely are a different person from the person that you were. We were very emotional. We could get upset very, very easily. We would still think about our friends who had gone. And it was really, life was difficult, really, in the village in terms of growing up without friends.
An effort to try to get the community to help itself, to lay down its differences and focus on mental health, worked for some. So did individual therapy and ad hoc efforts by school teachers to get the children to talk to each other. But all those affected were not Abervon residents. At least 2,000 or more of the rescue squads had been from other close locales, but not included in any kind of community outreach. There were suicides, premature deaths of parents, estrangements, an overwhelming number of cases of remembered trauma, depression, the ongoing guilt of having survived, the ongoing guilt of not having done more, and the reluctance of a certain generation of men to even seek help. Add this to the fact that coal miners are already taxed with an inordinately high incidence of pulmonary diseases and black lung. The fund was big, but it was also limited. Some things can't be fixed. For those who lived through that October morning, all the money in the world was never going to be enough to be whole again. In 1997, Prime Minister Tony Blair's government paid back the £150,000 it had openly pilfered from the disaster fund. In 2007, the Welsh government gave £1.5 million to the fund for their part in the wrongful use of the donated cash. Lord Robins, the NCB chairman who waited a full day before getting himself to Aberfan and would be awash in dubious excuse-making, would do a serious 180 when he later went on to be responsible for breathtaking workplace safety reforms. In his work on the 1972 Robins Report, he championed making employees safer at work and giving them a shared sense of responsibility for it, making sure the workplace atmosphere was not a top-down operation, but one which listened to employee concerns. He is also given a large amount of the credit for enactment of the Health and Safety at Work Act of 1974 and the creation of the Health and Safety Commission, both considered landmark actions that transformed Britain's occupational safety landscape. Queen Elizabeth would weep in public again, but she was much older when she showed her personal grief at the funerals of both Princess Margaret and Prince Philip. She is also said to have cried when they decommissioned her yacht, which is a tad odd, given her trademark stoicism. Which doesn't mean she didn't feel. The Queen stayed in contact with many of those affected in the village. In addition to her initial visit on October 29, 1966, she returned 7 years later to open the memorial garden where the school once sat. 4 years after that, she and Prince Philip were on hand to plant a commemorative tree. Her last visit was in 2012, when she helped to christen a new school in the village. On more than one occasion, the Queen said that one of the greatest regrets of her 70-year reign was that she waited 8 days to go to Aberfan. Her thinking at the time was that she would just be in the way of the real work there, you know, that people would worry about pomp or protocol, and she didn't want that. Still, she said, I should have gone sooner. In Wales today, the government has established a task force to examine the now long-abandoned coal tips. They had identified more than 2,566 such tips, which are now rated on their likelihood of risk and are assigned rigorous reinspection schedules. The town of Aberfan still sits at the base of the mountain that once betrayed it. In a Wales Online story from 2020, the agreed-upon center of town is the Trinity Child and Family Center, which the newspaper described as, quote, a place of happiness for children in a place so long associated with unimaginable loss, end quote. The center, by the way, is now the town's biggest employer. The river that ran beside it, once riven with pollution from the mines and overage from the tips, now runs clear. You can even fish for trout in it as you dodge herons and the occasional otter. No one in Aberfan burns coal in their chimneys anymore for warmth, but no one there forgets. To research this episode, journalist Amy Wilson read Aberfan, Government and Disaster by Ian McLean and Martin Jones, as well as Aberfan, A Story of Survival, Love and Community in One of Britain's Worst Disasters by Gaynor Madgwick. She also read many BBC dispatches from and retrospectives about the tragedy. Those were supplemented by many high-quality documentaries that showed the event in all its enormity and all its horror. Crimes of the Centuries is available early and ad-free through Grab Bag Collab. Join us at patreon.com/grabbagcollab to hear not just exclusive content related to this show, but to also get access to several other shows on our profit-sharing network. Unless noted in the citations, this case was researched and written by me, Amber Hunt, and produced by Amanda Rassman and Henry Lavoie. Original music is by Bruce Hunt, Andrew Higley, and occasionally by my son, Hunt Van Benskoten. Other music comes from Soundstripe and Epidemic Sound. If you like the show, help us out by rating and reviewing us on Apple Podcasts. For more information or to recommend a case, go to centuriespod.com. On Instagram, we're at centuriespod, and check out our Crimes of the Centuries podcast Facebook page.